The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
The Coin Bureau podcast is a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Coin Bureau podcast. This is Mad Mike Mooch.
Woo!
And I am Guy. Welcome, everyone. Mike, where are we recording from today?
We are in Sweden.
Sweden?
Yeah, man.
Lovely.
I'm enjoying it. They're very hospitable here.
They're very chilled, aren't they?
Very chilled.
They're very chilled.
Great food.
People.
Very affordable furniture.
Yeah. 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 I mean, you have to make it yourself. Which is
a bit like everything in life, if you think about it.
Very profound. So we've shipped our portable studio here to Sweden.
Yep.
And because we just felt like it.
Yeah.
Sweden sounded cool. Get it before it gets really cold, I guess.
Yeah.
And obviously Sweden's in the news a lot at the moment because ABBA are reforming, aren't they? Or they've reformed and are now...
I didn't know they split.
They split?
What? This is a nightmare. Are they all alive?
They're all alive, yeah.
Okay.
But they've reformed and are now going to be performing as holograms. Let's just give a quick recap of what we talked about last time before we launch into today's episode.
Sounds good.
Last time we talked about the history of money, didn't we? We talked about money as a technology that's evolved over time to become more usable, more useful, and it's driven human innovation. It's driven our achievements. And we also looked at the different types of money. I found that really good fun, looking at the way in which certain things were used as money. We talked about commodity money, didn't we?
You could pay
in salt. That was one of my favorite. And we got the Latin word. We got the word salary from that, a particular high point. And we also looked at things like the gold standard and the pros and cons of that. And how we moved from a commodity money system to the current system of money that we have today, which is obviously the fiat system. And do you remember what fiat meant?
I don't.
This was
I'm just full of meatballs and schnapps. So I'm my brain is not working today.
I'm going to give you a pass. You're a new dad. You're obviously not sleeping. You're obviously sort of semi conscious.
Yeah, I was on the bottle last night.
Partially crazed. Fiat, which is how
it was
we're
Latin, wasn't it?
That's right. That's right. It's Latin, and it means let it be done.
Let it be.
Let it
done.
So basically, fiat money is money by decree. It has value because the government issuing it says it has value.
Okay.
And the government backs up those claims with all its what people say.
With its gold standard, which isn't gold standard, but which is now more just like a lead standard.
Yeah, as in the currency is backed by lead.
Yeah, as in by power, I think firepower.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, by hot lead.
Yeah.
The currency is backed by the power of government, by the power that government has. A monopoly on violence, some people would say. And in the past, we obviously talked about the fact that money was backed by gold in a vault somewhere and how you could, in theory, for a long time, take a banknote to the bank and exchange it for that particular amount of gold.
Yeah.
Which was pretty crazy. But that ceased, and we've eventually worked our way to this system where you could not possibly do that. You'd get laughed out of the bank. But do you want to hear a couple of fun facts about gold?
Yeah.
Good, because you're going to anyway. when I was researching this the other day, I came across the Bank of England's website and I was having a look on that. The Bank of England holds 400,000 bars of gold in its vaults.
Really?
And that is worth around £200 billion.
Really?
Yeah. And this, unfortunately, this is only the second largest haul of gold in the world. Do you know who has the largest?
Is it a rapper?
It's not.
Is it Fat Joe?
It's Jay-Z. Jay-Z has more gold than the Bank of England. That wouldn't surprise me. It's the Federal Reserve.
Oh, the Americans?
Yeah, basically. Okay. Uncle Sam.
Uncle Sam.
Uncle Sam. But interestingly, the Bank of England's gold reserves, that £200 billion worth, it corresponds to between 4 and 5% of the actual pounds in circulation.
Really?
So that is the extent to which the British currency is backed today. And yeah. I think it's probably a similar story. In fact, I would hazard a guess and say it's a lot less.
In America.
All this is why governments around the world have been able to print so much money, especially over the last 18 months because of the pandemic and because of the economic slowdown that we've had. And this obviously leads to inflation, which we're experiencing now. So the supply of money has increased. There's more money sloshing around in the system, which means that all that money is kind of worth less because there's so much of it. It's less of a commodity. And this is what we're seeing with prices going up. Again, estimates vary as to the rate of inflation. Some people think that the government, the US government, is deliberately underrepresenting, underestimating the true level of inflation. But it's definitely climbing. It's kind of complicated by the fact that prices are going up because of supply chain issues and things like that. Obviously, the global shutdown has made life pretty difficult for exporters and trade and all this sort of thing. But inflation is happening. And there's also the danger, of course, and some people think this could happen, about possible hyperinflation.
Mm.
And hyperinflation is basically, I guess the way to sum up hyperinflation is money in wheelbarrows. So this is where they print so much money, it becomes completely worthless. People lose confidence in the currency. Prices rocket. So we saw this. In Venezuela. Yeah, Venezuela, sort of perhaps most recently Zimbabwe as well.
Germany before the kerfuffles.
Before everything kicked off again.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in Weimar Germany after the First World War and before the Second. Yeah, they had massive runaway hyperinflation. And you hear stories from Venezuela and also Argentina. Like Argentina had terrible hyperinflation. Yeah. And you hear stories about people getting their sort of weekly or monthly salary and basically being given it in carrier bags full of money and then having to run to the shop in order to buy what provisions they could because the prices were going up all the time. So by the time you got to the checkout, what you were trying to buy would often have gone up. The price would have gone up even more.
So what you'd save a space at the checkout.
Yeah.
and then just, oh, I've left my...
Yeah.
Run it through. Ah, oh, crap. Ah, oh, I've left my card. Wait here one second.
Just wait.
One
just
second.
I mean, I find going to the supermarket, especially when it's busiest, was stressful enough thing as it is. So...
Yeah, life is hard.
Like... But yeah, so hyperinflation is obviously is pretty catastrophic.
Yeah.
And yeah, this happens all the time. Let's start by talking about cash, and we're gonna use the example throughout this next bit of me paying you £10.
Yeah.
You're going to be pretty wealthy by the end of this.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Something to look forward
to. I can get my shopping delivered.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. All your aspirations.
By nymphs.
That's a good business idea. Yeah. I like that. So yeah, we'll talk about cash now and the other ways in which we move money around on a daily basis. Because now some of what we're going to talk about, it might seem on the face of it kind of a little basic, a little elementary.
To but, you, I'm learning.
To you, it's going to completely.
This is calculus.
You are going to have your mind blown. But it is easy to lose sight of how we transact with each other
yeah.
all the time. So let's imagine we're making a cash transaction. I am paying you £10.
Sick.
And so what are the benefits, do you think, of that of transacting in cash? Is there anything that kind of leaps to mind?
Traceless. Do you know what I mean? It's anonymous, really, isn't it? So you could be paying me for something that might be a little bit... shameful.
Yes.
Legal, but shameful. Like an adult magazine.
Okay, yeah.
Or something, or you know, yeah. or something else.
Yeah, or something else. Something, yeah, something that I don't want other people to know about, something maybe illicit, or something that, you know, I would rather...
Yeah, it's personal.
Yeah, it's personal. It's just between me
and... A Brazilian butt lift.
For £10. Wow. Yeah.
It's not the best job.
It's not the best example.
Yeah.
A portion of a Brazilian yeah. uplift. Yeah. So, yeah, it's anonymous. There is no one else involved in that transaction. It's purely peer-to-peer, as is a term you'll hear in crypto a lot. It's me and you. And, yeah, so it's anonymous. There's no one else involved. No one else knows anything about the transaction. It's also instant. So I hand you the £10. You hand me the voucher for the butt lift or whatever it is I'm buying, and we both go on our way. There's nothing else needs to happen. It's finished. It's done.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's quick. There's no kind of chargebacks. There's no having to wait for the money to clear in your account or anything like that. We're done and we can move on. And also, what's great about it being instant is, say we're doing a business transaction and, you know, you're a supplier of Brazilian butt lifts or whatever it is. The good thing for you about it being instant is then you can take that money and perhaps pay your employees or your yeah. suppliers, you know, because you have liabilities, you have obligations. And the great benefit of the transaction being quick is that you then have that money straight away.
Instantly.
And you can and you can spend it. Okay, so on the face of it, then a cash transaction is pretty good. But what are the drawbacks? Is there anything that strikes you?
I mean, you physically have to be there.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't sort of post cash, or you can, but it's not.
You wouldn't
wise.
No. I mean, yeah, a £10 note inside a birthday card from your aunt
might get is borrowed by the naughty mailman.
Yeah, you have to rely on a third party. You have to rely on the post.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, you can move cash around, but essentially, you're absolutely right. You have to be in the same place. And this is cash's major problem. This is the big drawback of using cash. You have to be face to face because no one is going to be comfortable sending large amounts of money. And it also to send large amounts of money, you know, using the post would cost you. You know, you'd be constantly having to buy stamps and envelopes and all that sort of stuff, and you'd be worried that
it's not instantaneous. Yeah.
It's not instantaneous. Yeah, you're reliant on the postal service. So yeah, that's the major problem with cash. You have to be in the same place, and there's also you're quite vulnerable if you're carrying cash around.
Yeah, you can lose it easily.
Yeah, and I was
either from lacking and the ops getting you, or if you just you drop it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm quite good like this. I generally tend, touch wood, never to sort of lose or drop my wallet. But I mean, you are terrible.
I'm awful. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, follow
me. In fact, I've seen you. I've seen you many years ago, I think. You were sort of putting your... I think you'd had a couple of drinks, and you were trying to put your wallet in your back pocket, and it was just missing, and you were just dropping it on the floor, and then you did the same with your phone, and you dropped it on the floor.
Yeah.
And I was like...
That Mike. Sounds about right.
Yeah, I was like, Mike, come on, you know. So, yeah, and certain people are hopeless. But I was thinking about this on the way over here today. I was thinking, you know, I've got my bank card in my wallet, and that gives me access to... Not actually that much money, but you know, there's about £1,000 in my account at the moment.
Mm.
Now, I'm perfectly happy to carry that bank card around because there's inbuilt security on that. I would feel really uncomfortable carrying £1,000 in cash around.
Mm.
I mean, it would take up a lot of space, wouldn't it? But I'd be really paranoid about dropping my wallet or you know, or someone seeing that I had a huge wad of notes in there.
Yeah.
It's not ideal.
No.
So that's another drawback of cash. And again, I think the other drawback would be it's not much use if we're trying to do a large transaction. Like, say we're trying to buy a house.
Yeah.
No one is going to appreciate you turning up with a carload of cash to buy a house. No. So how do we solve the problem of transacting at a distance then? How do we get...
Catapults.
I set up a catapult... And I hope that it lasts.
Yeah.
That's an innovative solution. But I would say that the ability to transact at a distance without having to be in the same room as someone is a massive innovation, one of the great innovations of our time, because without it, the world economy would fall apart pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So to do this, obviously, we use digital money. Now, this is a broad term, digital money. So I'm going to break it down a little bit and consider the ways that the things that fall under the umbrella of digital money. But it's basically, you can think of it as any form of money transfer that doesn't involve cold hard cash. So that would be things like card payments, credit card, debit card, bank transfers. And you've also now increasingly got payment providers, things like PayPal. Yeah, or Venmo.
Look at Cash that. App.
Cash App, yeah. We were right. We were really in sync there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't think of Cash App. But obviously, the benefits of these digital forms of money are obvious. We don't need to be in the same place. We don't have to carry large amounts of cash around. We can transfer large amounts of money between each other if needs be, and we don't have to use wheelbarrows.
This is all good.
This is great. But there are, of course, drawbacks to digital payments.
What are they?
Okay, well... I alluded to this earlier when I was talking about cash transactions, but one of the drawbacks is that any digital transaction, any digital money transaction, has to have someone else involved. So if I'm going to send you money digitally, if I'm going to send you this £10 that I apparently owe you, someone is going to have to facilitate that transaction because it's either going to be a bank. There's going to be a card company involved, or I might be paying you via PayPal, any of those ways, but there's someone in the middle of that. And so that means oversight. You know, that means that transaction is no longer anonymous. So yeah. It's logged and people can see. So if I'm trying to buy something that I don't want people to know about, you know, I don't want people to know that I'm having a Brazilian butt lift.
Or if you're donating to, say, WikiLeaks.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, perhaps I'm donating to an organisation that the government isn't comfortable with, and WikiLeaks is a great example.
Or ISIS.
Or ISIS, yeah. On the other hand, maybe I want to give money to ISIS. Yeah, so there's someone, because someone is in the middle to facilitate this transaction, they can also see this transaction happening. They can stop it. And if you talk to anyone who especially works in retail, and they do online sales or anything like that, they'll tell you that things like chargebacks are a real problem.
Mm.
So if you send a product out to someone and they're not happy with it for any reason, or you know, they claim it doesn't arrive or anything, it's, you know, something goes wrong, then they can initiate a chargeback. And so the transaction is kind of frozen or reversed. And I think PayPal, especially, if you have, as a merchant, if you have too many chargebacks, if things go wrong, like say you send things out via the post, if the post lets you down, if the postal service lets you down, then you get these chargebacks coming towards you. There's nothing you can do about it. And then all of a sudden PayPal will freeze your account, which obviously puts... Yeah. Exactly. Which puts a real spanner in the works. So having someone else involved isn't ideal. because it means oversight, because it means that the transaction can be stopped, it can be reversed, it can be interfered with. And also, we have to trust these people. We have to put our faith in them. And in order, I mean, here in the West, I'm going to talk about the developed world quite a lot because we are so used to using all of these things. But we don't often consider that we have to put our faith. We're putting a lot of faith in these people. If we make a large transaction, say, we're putting a lot of faith in the banks involved making that transaction. We have to trust them. Now, in order that we can trust them, there's another layer added in, and that's obviously government. So they, government and regulators. Because we have to trust these people, because we have to trust these third parties, the likes of PayPal or banks or whatever, there has to be another layer of oversight involved. And this is where government and regulators come in. So they maintain the trust that we have in these companies. So they make sure that they're behaving properly. So that's a kind of another layer involved in a digital payment. Not only have you got the middleman, but you've also got
oversight.
Yeah, you've also got the entity overseeing the middleman. So there's a lot of scrutiny. And this is the price. This is one of the prices that we pay for the convenience of digital payments. We have to live with the fact that there are people involved and there are people watching. And so the payments we make in this way, they're traceable. They're linked to our identities. The third parties can see what we're spending our money on. And if governments or law enforcement or anyone like that requests or asks to see those transactions, those third parties are often legally obliged to pass them on. So if you're a fan of privacy, if you don't want everyone to know, if you don't want the government to know what you're spending, And again, like WikiLeaks is a great example here. You might not want the US government to know that you're donating to WikiLeaks. So if you like privacy, this is a problem.
Also, the US government was able to stop you donating to WikiLeaks.
Yeah, yeah. So not only is there oversight, not only
not that I donated, but...
Well, you wouldn't say it. No. Well, this is why WikiLeaks started being paid in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
But we're getting slightly ahead of ourselves there because we will come back to that. So before we look at how digital payments are made, because I want to kind of break this down into how this money moves around, because there are so many misconceptions around it. But first, we need to talk about the big problem that digital payments need to overcome. And this is called the double spend problem. And this is really important to understand. This is a key foundation of sort of everything that's involved with digital payments, with modern money, and also with cryptocurrency. This idea of double spend. So the big problem with any asset that's digital is that can easily be copied. I mean, it can be a case of just copy and paste. So think back the last time someone sent you a funny image over WhatsApp or something like that. You have no way of ensuring that image is unique. It's easy to copy and redistribute, and you could say that, I mean, meme culture, wouldn't work without it. These files can easily be copied and sent to anyone else, and you have no way of preventing that. If digital files couldn't be easily copied and redistributed, I mean, the lives of anyone under about 45 would just instantly fall apart. They wouldn't know what to do with themselves. So any form of digital money exists basically in the form of files, and digital files are easy to copy.
Yeah.
So if I sent you such a file as a payment, you can't be sure that I haven't copied it and sent it to someone else. Now, obviously, this uncertainty makes the asset worthless. So the system collapses because you have no confidence in the money. If I can send you these digital pounds and then send the same digital back, copy and paste and send the same digital pounds to someone else, that's no good to anyone. And people, you couldn't rely on people to stay honest like that. No. So this is why the third parties, this is another reason that the third parties we talked about earlier exist. They are overseeing they're the ones that make sure this doesn't happen. They act as bookkeepers. They keep records up to date. So they track the fact that I've sent that £10 to you, and they update the books, which means I can't then send that £10 again. Do you see? So, and they're able to do this because someone, again, is regulating them. So, the croupiers are being watched by the pit operator.
And,
there's all this oversight. So essentially what it comes down to is that two layers of security are needed when it comes to digital payments. So firstly, you need third parties to process and oversee those payments, and you need a regulatory body in place in order to keep the third parties themselves honest and make sure that they're not cooking the books and awarding themselves, you know, extra pounds that they've magicked out of thin air. So there's a lot more people involved. When you make a digital payment, when I send you £10, it's a lot more people involved than just the two of us.
Yeah.
And again, this is a big issue when it comes to digital payments. Now, we'll come back to this whole problem of double spending when we talk about Bitcoin, because actually the inventor of Bitcoin, Satoshi Nakamoto, the big problem that he had to overcome with creating this digital currency, this digital cash, the big problem he had to overcome was the double spend. How do you prevent it? But that is a topic for another episode. Shall we take a break?
Let's have a break.
Let's have a break.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Welcome back to part two.
Part two.
How digital money works.
Magic.
We're going to get technical here. So let's look at how banks transfer money between themselves.
Yeah.
The real rock and roll stuff. The stuff that goes on behind the scenes when we make payments to one another.
Yeah.
The nuts and bolts. I want at this point to give credit to a book called The Basics of Bitcoins and Blockchains by a chap called Anthony Lewis here. Because
big up Anthony.
Big up Anthony. Good work, Anthony. His book is excellent at explaining this. There's loads of useful diagrams and illustrations and things like this. I've used that book a lot researching this, and I urge you to read it, everyone, because it's great. Obviously it does what it says on the tin, but it goes into a lot of detail like this that is really important to know. So big up Anthony. Thank you. So, Mike, if people think about it at all, they tend to imagine that when we make a bank transfer, money kind of gets sent from one account to another. So back to our example, I'm transferring you £10.
Yeah.
The assumption would be that somehow that £10 makes its way from my bank account to your bank account.
Yeah.
And everyone's happy. But this isn't the case. This is not true at all. So we want to get this. We want to get rid of this idea.
Dispel that rumor.
Yeah, exactly. Dispel that rumor. Get rid of this idea that somehow kind of money itself, physical money, if you like, is moving behind the scenes.
What is moving?
Well, it's mostly numbers on spreadsheets. But let me explain. So let's start off with the simplest type of transaction. Let's quickly, before we talk about bank transfers, about how they do this, let's quickly talk about assets and liabilities. So the money that's in your bank account, Mike, is an asset that belongs to you.
Yeah.
Okay. But for the bank, that money is a liability. So the bank actually owes you that money. So all the money in your bank account is currently the liability of whoever you're banking with. So if you ask for that money, let's say you go to a cash machine or you you make a card payment, you know, you instruct the bank basically to make a payment, then the bank is duty bound to fulfill that obligation, to fulfill that liability, to give you that money when you ask for it. So this is important to remember. So it's our asset and it's the bank's liability. So we'll be talking kind of in terms of assets and liabilities a bit from this point on. So just to let you know, to clear up any confusion around that. So there are four different types of bank transfer, and we're going to see how they actually work. Now, I don't want to get too technical on this. There are loads of different terms and things. And again, Anthony Lewis, in his great book, he takes you through all these terms. I'm going to kind of go lightly on those because I think it might kind of clog things up a little bit.
Sure.
So let's start off with the simplest type of bank payment, and that's a same bank payment. So I'm paying you £10, but we both
bank with the same person.
Exactly. Bank with the same bank.
Easy.
Exactly. So this is straightforward. I instruct the bank to pay you £10. So the bank then updates its records. So it takes £10 out of my account, out of the assets I have, and it updates its records to move to add £10 to your account. Okay, so this type of transaction, we say it clears. So it clears internally. The bank's records are updated, and it will show my assets to be £10 fewer, and your assets to be £10 more. It's fairly simple, and basically, this is numbers being updated on a huge database. From the bank's point of view, therefore, it will be liable for £10 fewer to me, but it will owe you £10 more. Okay?
Sure.
Pretty straightforward. Nothing too complicated has had to happen here. It's basically a case of a spreadsheet being updated. But things start to get a little more complicated when we have different banks. So you bank with one bank, Bank A, and I bank with another bank, Bank B. So the same thing kind of happens when I send you this £10, in that our balances at each of our banks, they are adjusted on the records that the banks hold. But your banks, the problem comes in the fact that your bank's liabilities, i.e. the amount that it owes you, they have increased by £10, whereas my bank's liabilities have decreased. Okay, so from the point of view of your bank, this isn't great because suddenly they're liable to more money for you. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So obviously this needs to be settled up because if that isn't, then your bank is not going to be too happy about it. So now once back in the past, this would have been done physically, and what would have happened was that cash was basically transferred between banks. So we're talking loading up cash into a van, and transporting it between the two. So my bank would owe your bank a certain amount of money, and at some point that money would have to be transported over. Now, obviously, you can see the problems with that. If you've seen the movie Heat, for instance. I mean, if you've seen any number of Hollywood movies. Mm. Security vans, armored cars, whatever, they get robbed. they get held up. So that's
and then the liability changes.
Yeah,
then that things, goes to someone else.
Then things get really complicated. So obviously, if they were to operate like that, they have to spend a lot of money, obviously, on vehicles, personnel, security, yeah. all this sort of stuff, insurance, et cetera. So this is obviously not ideal. So the banks have evolved two ways of doing this digitally. Now, the first way is called correspondent bank accounts. So basically, a correspondent bank account is a bank account held by a bank.
Ah, clever.
At another bank. Okay, so let's go back to our example. My bank has an account at your bank. And then when we make our £10 transaction, my bank instructs your bank to deduct £10 from my bank's bank account that it holds with your bank.
Got it.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, kind of inception banking, but yeah. I like it.
And then that £10 is obviously credited to your account, to your list of assets, if you like. And this allows the liabilities of both banks to be squared off and neither ends up out of pocket. Okay? And the clearing of the transaction is basically approved and finalized by the bank that receives the money. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, the problem with correspondent banking is that it means every bank needs to have a funded account with every other bank. You can't just have an account. You actually need to have money in that account in order to meet the liabilities that payments from your customers would create. Okay? So, you know, there are thousands of banks all around the world, and this becomes pretty impractical when you have a large and well-developed banking system. Because just managing all of the accounts at these other banks, that would be a huge amount of work. It would tie up a lot of funds because each bank would need to keep a certain amount of money. And you'd imagine it would be a fairly large amount of money in order to cover, you know, all most possible liabilities. So keeping all the correspondent accounts funded would be expensive. It would take a lot of time and a lot of work.
So they don't do that much?
It still happens, but I think not at the level it kind of used to.
So that's an antiquated way of dealing with this problem, but they've got something new now, I assume?
Exactly.
Would that be?
Well, I'll tell you. It leads me nicely on to what are called central bank accounts. And this is a more practical solution. The correspondent bank accounts do exist. They are still used. And, you know, I think probably the bigger banks in this country, they may well still use them because, you know, there's only a handful of banks. But what is becoming more popular is a central bank account, a more practical solution where every bank holds an account with the central bank in its territory. So for our purposes, the Bank of England, if you're in America, the Fed, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the central bank does the job of keeping these accounts updated as transactions are made between banks. Okay, so all this, the big spreadsheet, if you like, the big account book, the big Excel sheet is kept up to date by the central bank. So there are two ways that the central bank does this, and I'm going to keep this as simple as possible because otherwise we stray into the realms of banking jargon
and boredom.
Yeah, they go hand in hand, and we don't want to inflict that on our listeners. So yeah. I'll keep it simple, and I'll try and keep it brief. So the two ways that the central bank keeps track and updates the records are these. So first, you have a deferred net settlement, DNS. Now, this is when the central bank keeps a record of all transactions made over the course of the day. And then at the end of the day, it calculates which bank owes money to the others. So obviously, you know, your bank will be making transactions, my bank will be making transactions, all the other banks will be transacting, some banks will be up, some banks will be down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So at the end of the day, this is all calculated, and then any banks that owe money to other banks settle up with a single payment. Now, if the only transaction that had happened between our two banks had been £10 from my bank to your bank, then your bank would be awarded £10 at the end of the day. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
The key thing here is that it happens at the end of the day.
So is this like when you used to spend on your bank card and it would see in your bank account, you'd look at it.
Mm-hmm.
I've got loads of cash.
Exactly.
I was out on the Raz last night. don't remember what I spent. May have dropped my wallet.
Yeah.
May have bought a couple of lucky ladies, a couple of lemon sherbets. Wake up in the morning. Didn't seem that bad.
Yeah.
A day later, I'm eating gruel for the rest of the month.
Exactly. And this, I mean, this takes me back to when we were at university together. I mean, this used to happen all the time. So this is about 20 years ago now, isn't it? But maybe not quite. God, really? 20 years?
It is, yeah.
That's depressing. Okay, so this is it. Yeah, I remember that exactly as you say. You'd go out and you'd spend a whole load of money. You wouldn't really remember. And then you'd check your balance the next day. You know, you'd either, I guess you could go, you used to go to a cash machine, didn't you? And you'd get a little printout of your balance. And you'd be like, oh, okay, I've still got, I got more money than I thought. And then sure enough, the next time you spend it. And this is what happens. Basically, these transactions weren't being cleared and settled in a timely manner. They were being batched up at the end of the working day. And I think sometimes the weekend could deal with that.
Yeah.
That was a real sting, wasn't it?
Yeah, because you'd have 2 days of, woo!
Yeah, exactly. You'd go out on a Friday and Saturday night and the banks wouldn't work Sundays and nothing would happen on Sundays. And then Monday was just bleak.
And then Suicide Tuesday.
Suicide Tuesday, exactly. And that's where it came from. It's the banking system's fault. So this is kind of antiquated. Deferred net settlement DNS is fallen out of fashion, and I don't think anyone really mourns the passing of it.
No,
because I mean, I for one find it so useful to know, to be able to check my balance. I mean, nowadays obviously we all check it on our phones, don't we? But to actually know that I'm up to date. If it says I've got £100 in my account, then I've got £100 in my account. And this is thanks to something called real-time gross settlement, RTGS, the acronym you never thought you owed so much to. So, under RTGS, the central bank updates the records of each bank in real time. So this means account balances are obviously updated in real time, and as we've noticed. And that, I think, is a great improvement. So, yeah, obviously, RTGS is the system that's preferred nowadays. It does mean that banks have to have more in their accounts with central banks to make sure that the payments are constantly going through.
Yeah.
But the convenience of it is obvious.
Yeah.
And so both DNS and RTGS, the clearing is done by the central bank. So the central bank kind of handles everything. But to complicate things still further, not every bank can have a central bank account. So the ones that do are known as clearing banks, and they themselves clear the transactions of smaller banks who can't get a central bank account. Now, this is going to be important when we come to talk about the unbanked later on. But yeah, it's...
So like your classics, like your HSBC, your Lloyds, your... NatWest. I don't know if they're the big ones. Is NatWest a big one?
NatWest is a big one, yeah. So they will all have accounts with the Bank of England. Mm. But
you're tied.
Yeah, say there's, if such a thing exists, say there's a tiny little high street bank in... Yeah, so smaller banks, you couldn't just start up your own bank and get an account with the central bank. So what you end up with is a kind of pecking order with central banks at the top. Then you have clearing banks, your kind of big, well-known household name high street banks, and then smaller banks below that who have their transactions cleared by the sort of bigger banks slightly higher up, who in turn have their transactions cleared by the central bank. So let's just take a quick time out here to say to have a think about all this that we've discussed so far. It should be pretty clear by this point that there's a lot more going on behind the scenes than I think most people would imagine to transfer to move this money around.
You just think it's a computer.
Yeah.
And it's like one big computer that does it all.
Perhaps, yeah.
But it's not.
Exactly. And the more you kind of read about this, the more you realize actually a lot of people who work in finance, who work maybe not in bank, you'd hope that bankers would know about it. But, you know, financial professionals and stuff, unpicking this system of transferring money, of moving money around, a lot of them can't even do it because they couldn't give you a detailed explanation of how it works.
Because they don't subscribe to the iHeart Coin Bureau podcast.
Exactly. What happens when we start talking about cross-border payments? So now we've moved beyond the realms of different banks.
Dealing with those goddamn foreigners.
Exactly.
And their funny money.
And their funny money and their funny ways.
God, the problems we had when we'd go away on holiday. and you'd just be dealing with a brand new currency, and you're going, am I rich? Am I poor? Am I how much is this beer costing me?
Yeah.
Am I getting fleeced for this henna tattoo? Mm. Yes is the answer to that one.
Yes, you are wasting your money.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. You go abroad and you think, okay, this is a funny looking banknote. It's got a big number on it. Isn't
yeah.
It? Is that good?
Or should I wipe my ass with this?
Yeah, that question that came up a lot. Yeah, so let's talk about cross-border payments. But we're going to stick with the same currency because things get way more complicated when you start chopping currencies around. So, again, let's use an example. I'm paying you £10 from my UK bank account, but you've gone over to Ireland, say, maybe just to sort of get away whilst the heat dies down and, you know, just make yourself scarce. But I need to send you this £10 to your bank that's in another country. So what where we're at is now we're back at correspondent bank accounts. So your Irish bank will maintain an account at my UK bank. When I make the payment, the £10 is simply being moved from my bank to your bank's UK account.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it stays within the currency zone that it originates from, in this case, the UK. Bigger banks may have subsidiaries in other countries, in which case those subsidiaries would handle this type of transaction. So say I banked with HSBC, there's a good chance that there would be an HSBC subsidiary in Ireland. I mean, it's probably there anyway. I don't know. I haven't been to Ireland for a long time. So in that case, yeah, it would be fairly simple. But what if we don't want to transact purely in pounds? What if I want to send you $10? Okay. So if my bank and your bank don't have US banking licenses, we're talking US dollars here, obviously, then each must have a correspondent bank account, but back to those again, with a US bank. You follow?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if it's with the same US bank, then that clears the transaction and updates the records. But if it's with different banks, then the transaction is cleared by the central bank, in which case the Fed. So again, in order to facilitate all this, loads of different banks in loads of different countries, they need loads of different correspondent accounts and open with each other's banks. In order to move some dollars around. So again, really, really unwieldy. And that brings us on to the last type of bank transaction, and that is a foreign exchange, a Forex transaction. So here's the scenario. I want to pay you £10, but you want to receive it in euros in your Irish bank account. Okay? So in this case, what we need is a middleman who is basically willing to exchange the two currencies, in this case, pounds and euros, because there's no way that the pounds that I'm sending can somehow get turned into euros by the computer or anything else. You know, someone needs to actually exchange these.
Broker that deal.
Exactly. Broker the deal. So sometimes the banks fulfill this role. So if my bank had an account at your bank, one of these correspondent banks, bank accounts again, then they can transact.
And they got
themselves a
few euros in the back of the sofa. Oh, we could probably handle that ourselves.
Fulfill that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can clear that. So if our banks don't have this relationship, then we could use what's known as a money transfer operator, an MTO. There's another little acronym for you.
Me and Shelley.
Shelley, an MTO. So these are third parties, like Western Union, which we talked about earlier, MoneyGram, Skrill, or Wise. Wise used to be called
TransferWise.
Yeah. They handle foreign currency transactions, and they're used by hundreds of millions of people across the world to send money in the form of remittances. Again, this is something that we're going to talk about in a minute. But yeah, these sort of transactions are obviously incredibly common. People in other countries wanting to basically send money home. But it's no use.
The cash catapult.
The cash catapult. Why? When will this idea be made flesh? Yeah, so it's no good someone, let's say someone from Kenya is working in the UK. They want to send money back, but they want their dependents, say their family in Kenya, to receive it as Kenyan shillings,
yeah,
because they're not going to want British.
Is that
pounds.
The actual
Kenyan shillings? Yeah, obviously a relic of imperialism. Now, these money transfer operators, these MTOs, they do, of course, charge fees for their services. Mm. And these can be as high as 10%. It depends on who you're using. Yeah. And so imagine if you're sending £100 from the UK to Kenya.
Is that because of the variance in different, like, so exchange rates? And they need to cover that? Or is it just, hey, these people are desperate?
Well, I think it's probably a bit of both. Someone I was listening to recently on another podcast did point out that one of the reasons why these fees are so high, like, you know, Western Union, for example, charges high fees, is that they have to use the banking infrastructure, and which, as we've seen, is really complicated. And so they need to kind of, you know, they need to...
It takes time.
It takes time.
Time is money.
Yeah, and as we're going to see in a moment when we talk about unbanked people, banking infrastructure is pretty involved. So Western Union kind of, I'm sure, would probably like to charge lower fees. But in order to cover their costs, because of the clunky nature of international banking, they kind of have to charge these fees because it's not an easy thing to do. And as we've seen, even moving money between different banks in the same country is clunky, is complicated, and involves a lot of work. So yeah, and then moving between different banks in different countries in different currencies, the system just gets more and more complicated. And when it gets complicated, it gets expensive. And unfortunately, these costs are covered by customers. They're covered by us. They're covered by anyone using these services. And in the case of remittances, it's been covered by and large by very poor people, which is not ideal.
No.
And yeah, so these MTOs, they are yet another centralized entity that people have to use in order to exchange money with each other. So it's clear that however we choose to move this money around, there are loads of just, I guess you'd say, moving parts.
Yeah, a lot of cogs, yeah. Wheels to be oiled and greased.
Exactly, that you've got to spray with WD-40 and all this sort of stuff. So yeah, these moving parts, these third parties, they have to be paid for their services. Mm. And so their profits come from us. On that note, should we take another break to digest all that?
I bet you're smart.
Yeah, and you like to hold your own in the group chat.
We can help you drop even more knowledge. My name is Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Izadi. We host a daily news podcast called Post Reports.
Every weekday afternoon, Post Reports takes you inside an important and interesting story with the kind of reporting that you can only get from The Washington Post.
You can listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. Go find it now and hit follow.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring? But don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents.
Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say "free this week" into your Xfinity voice remote.
Okay, so part three, card payments and e-money. Most of us in developed countries, we use credit or debit cards to pay for things on a daily basis, don't we? And I mean, lots of people now use their phones to pay for things. This system is now, it's so fast and supposedly seamless that we hardly think about what happens behind the scenes. Now, we've already seen what happens with trying to transfer money between banks. But making payments on card is equally, if not even more, complicated. Now, I found a really useful diagram on the Bank of England's website that explains card payments. And I'll try and leave it in the show notes if I possibly can. But it's a 10-step process.
Wow.
That it illustrates. So let's just talk everyone through this. So step one is the person paying using a card. Step two, the shop sends data to the provider of the card reader. Okay.
Okay, so that's an individual. Yeah, there's a few different providers of the card reader.
Exactly. So here's already, already we've got three people involved in this transaction. The person doing the paying, the merchant, and the provider of the card reader. Okay. So step three, provider of card reader sends request to Visa. Okay, so this is a Visa card, obviously. So there's a fourth person involved in the transaction. Step four, Visa sends authorization request to person's bank. This is the person obviously paying with the card. And there's another person involved. Step five, number five. So step five, by this point, we've got five people involved. Mm. Person's bank authorizes the transaction. Okay, fairly straightforward. Visa sends authorization to shop, to the merchant. Shop receives authorization. That's step seven. Step eight, provider of card reader sends list of transactions to Visa. Step nine, Visa and banks settle net transactions at Bank of England. Again, this idea of the central bank handling...
Clearing bank.
Yeah, exactly, acting as the clearing bank. There's another person involved, the Bank of England, the central bank, so that's now six people involved. And step 10, the final step, person's bank statement shows the money has gone out. Now, it's worth bearing in mind that this whole 10-step process takes seconds.
Yeah.
Which is incredible.
Yeah.
Given everything that's happening.
Or what often happens is Visa at step four, mm-hmm. Visa goes, this cunt's got no money. Visa goes, this guy's got no money. Decline that shit.
So, in that case, it's a four-step process.
Yeah.
Step one, person pays using card. Step two, shop sends data of provider to card reader. Step three, provider of card reader sends request to Visa.
Step five, hilarity, laughter.
Step four, Visa refuses to authorize the transaction. Step five, person exits shop sheepishly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is a 10-step process, assuming everything goes to plan and you haven't maxed out your card. And as you say, Mike, yeah, it happens in seconds, which is incredible.
Yeah.
So this is obviously a well-developed system that we've got. But as we've seen, I mean, I think the final total there was six people involved in the transaction.
That's all people who've got to get their palms greased.
Exactly. Exactly. And that leads us really nicely on to the next point that I wanted to make, because this system is so streamlined, it's so convenient on the face of it, that we often assume that card payments are free because we never get a statement. We never get a bill for these card payments. You've used your card 300 times this month. Mm. Here's a £3 bill or whatever it is for that convenience. We never get that.
Is it the merchant who gets dumped?
Yeah. So basically, payment networks like Visa and MasterCard and others, they levy charges on merchants who accept card payments. Okay, so in this case, it's the shop. Whoever's selling the goods to us, they are having to eat up the charge. Now, these charges, there's a range. It depends on quite a few factors, but they range from about 1.3% to 3.5% of every single transaction.
Yeah.
So... And in actual fact, the merchants pay, they pay three types of fees to accept credit cards in order to provide us with that convenience. Because let's face it, especially somewhere here like London, if a shop didn't take card, they would struggle.
I was out and about, and I was at a place called Vaulty Towers.
Mm-hmm. Vaulty Towers.
Vaulty Towers, which okay. is a pub linked to the vaults. Mm-hmm. Over in Waterloo, and they're card only.
Yeah,
the places don't take cash anymore.
Yeah, and it's becoming more and more common. And I think it's a bit of a grey area, it seems. But I think you're supposed to still accept cash.
But you then buses don't.
Do they not?
You can't pay for a bus fare.
Wow.
I mean, it's all right for you, Mr. Mr. Guy Coin Bureau. Mr. I have my shopping delivered. Mr. I take Ubers everywhere. Mr. I don't get on with the riffraff, but Mad Mike Mooch is a man of the people.
You're on the bus every day. Yeah, I can well appreciate that. That makes me look horribly out of touch amongst
no,
many
I mean,
other things.
No, buses,
but no, I mean, yeah,
buses are not they're to be avoided.
Well, I don't mind getting.
I prefer walking.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It is good to walk.
Mm.
But yeah.
To a taxi.
It is good to walk to the helipad, yeah. At any rate, rather than get the golf buggy. Let's get back to these. So merchants, as I say, they have to pay three types of fees in order for this convenience, which, as we've seen, you know, is just becoming more and more common. So the first is called an interchange fee. This is paid to the bank that issues the card. Okay. The second is called an assessment fee, and this is paid to the payment network, and that is your Visa or your MasterCard or the other payment networks are available. And they also have to pay processing fees. Now, these are paid to the payment processor. Now, the payment process, this is where it gets so complicated. And I got really kind of tied up and confused when I was looking into all this, because it's very difficult to tell who all these entities are sometimes. But to my understanding, the payment processor is the company that acts as a middleman between the shop, the merchant, and the banks. So when I swipe my card, say, the payment processor communicates with both my bank and the merchant's bank in order to authorize
like
the transaction.
iZettle or WorldPay or Square, like these, you see all these,
yes.
Like, is that the card?
As I understand it.
Okay.
As I understand it, yeah. So yeah, it's another layer of person. And so this is three different fees. That merchants are having to.
And does this all come out of that 1.3 to 3.5%?
I think that's covered within that. But there are also sometimes monthly subscription fees that merchants have to pay. And I think, you know, these are generally quite low. They're not too onerous. It might be maybe £20, $20 a month or something. But then they also have to get the equipment. They also have to get card readers and all these sorts of things. So the cost for the merchants is significant. They are having to pay a lot of convenience so that you or I can walk in and just go boop and go away again and be out of their hair. But you know what's coming. These costs that the merchants have to pay, they are passed quite naturally onto us. And this is seen in the form of higher prices across the board. So, you know, we're paying more to buy, for instance, a bottle of water in a shop than we might otherwise pay. But we're paying for that convenience. We're paying to be able to just tap and go. So this has meant that prices have gone up. Now, if you ask me, there should perhaps be a discount for paying with cash. I mean, you could reasonably argue that. I mean, you'd look like an absolute nutter, and you'd get told where to go pretty quickly. But you could argue that, couldn't
on the
you?
Bus. Say, we don't accept cash. I want a discount. We can't take it.
I want to pay with cash, and I want to pay less.
Do you take Kenyan shillings?
I will give you 20 Kenyan shillings to get to Highbury and Islington. No. Yeah, so obviously we're paying for this. You might say that it's a price worth paying. I, for one, am not in any rush to go back. This is, again, let's go back to our time at university together. I am in no rush to go back to those days, to the days of having to go into a bank and pay in a check. Like, you know, can I just say here and now that checks
can fuck off.
Exactly. Checks are one of the worst things ever. And I'm sure when your little boy grows up, when your little boy starts to, you know, use money and understand what it's all about, and spend it on stupid things like his old man did, I am sure that you will at some point he'll hear about checks. He will hear about the fact that sometimes we used to pay each other
an IOU note.
Yeah, by basically writing an IOU, by basically writing down on a piece of paper and signing it the amount of money, and then you would take that piece of paper along to a bank. You'd stand in line for someone to then process it.
And tell and you, he doesn't have the money.
And even if the money went through, even if you didn't get fined because the person giving you a check was a total crook, you'd still have to wait sometimes 5 days for it to clear.
Clear.
I mean, that is, yeah. I, for one, am in no rush to go back to those days. Fortunately, I don't think I can't imagine what sort of societal collapse we'd have to go through in order to get back to that. I suppose if the internet went down.
I'd rather go back to bartering.
Yeah.
Like it's just easier.
Go back to paying with salt.
Yeah.
And lumps of metal. Yeah. I'd quite happily, I'd sacrifice a lot not to have to go back to checks. But also this whole idea of having to walk into a bank branch and having to get cash out. Now, let's just quickly have a look before we move on to the sort of people who can't use any of these services. Before we show ourselves up, before we show ourselves up for the cosseted, pathetic Westerners that we are.
We are.
Let's just quickly talk about the recent rise in the last few years that we've seen of what I call e-money wallets. So these include things like PayPal. So, again, sort of third-party kind of payment providers. Do you know how many active users PayPal has, ballpark figure, as sort of late 2020-21?
35? 30,
just
35? 40? I don't know.
What? Just 35 people? Oh, you're talking millions.
Sure.
Okay.
I've got one.
You've got... and I've got one, so that's two.
That's two.
Joe's got one.
I don't know.
PayPal has 400 million active users.
Oh, I was close with... No.
No, you weren't. No. You were not close by. Even if you were going to tack million on...
Yeah, that was like
a tenth.
10% off of the total.
400 million active PayPal users. Again, that number's only growing.
I got PayPal because I had an eBay addiction.
Yeah, you did, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. What were you buying?
Anything. Anything, because it was the excitement, it was the rush.
Mm.
Oh,
a little
snipe bid. Now I'm the owner of this record, which I already have.
Which I don't.
I need
really
two.
Want.
I need doubles of it.
Yeah,
the old DJ Mad Mike merch.
I remember discovering internet shopping in kind of early 2000s. That's one of the few places I consider myself something of an early adopter. I kind of got internet shopping quite quickly. But I remember having to sign up to PayPal. I said, what's this? But actually, imagine trying to use eBay or any of these other sites now without PayPal.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, I mean...
Oh, no, if there's a PayPal symbol there, I click on that 99% of the time. Although I probably shouldn't, because even if you're paying with your credit card, if you pay with your credit card via PayPal, it doesn't have the same guarantees that the credit card companies have.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, if you buy something and it's shoddy or they go under, you can charge back from your credit card.
Yeah. And
it doesn't happen if it goes through PayPal and it's got a different set of terms and stuff.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I'm sure you can get chargebacks on PayPal, but...
Yeah, no, but if you buy something on a credit... So I bought festival tickets and this festival went under.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to get the money back.
Oh, I see. So, yeah. Oh, okay. So it's like a kind of built-in insurance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But okay. It wouldn't have happened, I don't think. Or it wouldn't have been as easy, or it might be a different process via PayPal.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, PayPal works really well. And e-commerce, I think, especially things like eBay, which actually bought PayPal, was one of the things that made Elon Musk as rich as he is.
Very, very rich. He's the richest man in the world now.
He is, yeah. which is saying something considering how rich Jeff Bezos is. So PayPal has 400 million active users as of late 2021. WeChat Pay, on the other hand, has 1.25 billion. Now, WeChat Pay is the sort of big rival of Alipay. So there are two, and they operate mostly in mainland China.
Mm.
And from what I've heard, I've never actually been to China, but from what I've heard, pretty much everyone, certainly the urban population of China, pretty much everyone uses either or both WeChat Pay and Alipay. So they're paying with their phones.
Yeah.
WeChat Pay, 1.25 billion users. Alipay, 676 million. And there's also the likes of Paytm or Paytm. I'm not quite sure how you pronounce it, which is popular in India. And that has 330 million users. Now, although these services in many cases have made payments even more convenient, and again, think about using PayPal on eBay and all that. But what they do is they make use of the existing payment rails that are in place. So obviously PayPal is linked to your bank account.
Yeah.
So although on the face of it, they seem to be kind of game changing and they do make things a lot more convenient. They're still using that clunky, very centralized systems, those clunky centralized systems behind the scenes. So they're using the, even though the process of paying by card may be ultra convenient for us, it still requires, whether we're using a card or whether we're using PayPal or WeChat Pay or whatever, that loads of infrastructure and middlemen to make sure that the system runs smoothly. It's a huge, huge machine. And this in turn pushes up prices. And the person who pays those prices is always...
Joe Public.
Exactly. It's always us, the consumer. Okay. So, having talked about all that, and having pointed out that, okay, this system may be huge and have all these moving parts, it is pretty convenient. We'd be kind of stuffed without it. But there are people out there who have none of these things, who don't have access to these sorts of services. And these people we're going to call the unbanked. Now, when we get deeper into crypto, you're going to hear the phrase the unbanked a lot. And a lot of crypto projects do things like talking about banking the unbanked, to the extent that it can sometimes be almost a kind of buzzword that just kind of trotted out. Oh, yeah, and bank the unbanked, et cetera, et cetera. But again, for us in places like the UK, it's hard to imagine not having access to banking services, because we take them for granted so much. We're so cosseted. We're so lucky, really. But there again, like, estimates vary about this. But it's thought that around 31% of the world's population, which is roughly 2 billion people, are unbanked. And let that sink in.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I find that absolutely mind-boggling. Now, I did a bit of digging and I found a list of the world's most unbanked countries. And it makes for pretty fascinating reading. So at the top of the list, and this, I believe, is pretty up to date. I think this is dated 2021, this list. At the top of this list, you have Morocco.
Wow.
I was surprised about that. 71% of Moroccans are unbanked. They don't have access to bank accounts, to PayPal, to anything like that. It might, in a way, be a cultural thing.
Mm.
It may be that people are particularly mistrustful of banks. We're going to look in a minute at some of the reasons why so many people are unbanked, because there are a few. But it is worth pointing out that, a lot of people don't trust banks. And have always dealt with cash, are used to dealing with cash, are used to perhaps keeping cash under the mattress, quite literally, and don't want to do it another way. So we shouldn't rule that out. I think that's a good point that you make. We shouldn't rule out the fact that some people may not want to participate in the system. But I think it's safe to say that the majority of the unbanked are unbanked through no choice or fault of their own. And it's interesting to look at that list. Next on the list after Morocco is Vietnam, with 69% of its population unbanked. And coincidentally, or well, no coincidence at all, I think, Vietnam was recently, I think, named top of the list of countries that are adopting crypto. And you see this a lot. Countries that have, where there isn't great banking access for most people are the ones that are
crypto
really picking
hotspots,
up.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And yeah, just looking down that list, you've got the likes of Egypt, the Philippines, Mexico, Nigeria, Peru, Colombia, Indonesia, Argentina. So fairly spread out.
Kenya
is there. And we're going to, as I said, we're going to talk about Kenya a little later on. But yeah, so there are right across the world, there are people unbanked. And actually, I looked up just...
And these are big percentages here. I mean, we started off with Morocco at 71. But if you go down to Argentina...
51.
Half the country.
Half the people.
A little bit over, 51.
Yeah. Argentina is an interesting case because we mentioned that it suffered hyperinflation.
That would explain.
I think for a lot of.
But does hyperinflation not just affect you even if you've got cash?
Yeah. I mean, not being banked would have a similar. You know, you wouldn't be safe. You wouldn't be safe from hyperinflation just because you didn't use a bank. But I think the point about Argentina is that it's lurched from economic crisis to economic crisis over the years. It's a real economically, it's a bit of a basket case. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of Argentines basically lost any faith in the current financial system a long time ago. And again, crypto is taking off in Argentina, as it is across lots of Latin America. But yeah, historically, Argentines, I think, have a pretty strained relationship with banks and economists in general. So yeah, it's pretty sobering to look at this list because, I mean, those percentages are in the millions of people who don't have access to banking. And so what does it mean to be unbanked? Well, it sucks, really, because it means that you're unable to fully participate in the economy. So it's harder to save because, you know, you have to keep cash under the mattress or hidden somewhere. And there's obviously a whole load of risks associated with that. So it's hard to save. You have to use cash, and there's plenty of risks with just using cash in general. You can't get credit. You can't get loans, you know, all these sorts of things. If you want to start up a business, you can't get a loan to start that business up if you don't have a bank account. No one's going to give you a loan, you know. So, again, we take these sort of things for granted. We're so used to having these. And here we are moaning about the difficulty of paying a check-in 20 years ago. And, yeah, when you consider that, just think how much crappier our lives would be if we had to go back to always using cash. Not most of us having bank accounts. And do you know, actually, I looked this up before we started. Do you know how many people in the UK are unbanked?
40.
You look like you're on safer ground with that bet. It's actually, from what I could find out, 1.3 million.
Okay.
Well, that is staggering. So we are, I think the
68
UK...
68 million.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a significant amount of people.
Yeah.
And again, this is something I think a lot of this is perhaps a lot of those unbanked people are perhaps unbanked by choice because they don't trust the banks.
But does that count like children?
No. So what these percentages are all based. These figures are all based on
adults.
I think, yeah,
people who are eligible for an account.
Yeah, but if you kind of extrapolate it out, let's say there are two parents who don't have banking, who are unbanked, that means by extension their children are unbanked. Let's say they have three, four children. Those children can't enjoy the benefits of their parents being banked. So in a way, that's kind of yet more people. These millions of unbanked, billions of unbanked people across the world, and over a million here in the UK, which I think is crazy. But again, a lot of people don't trust banks. And after 2008, I think you can, and the financial crash, you can't blame them. I think a lot of people, a lot of ex-offenders, people coming out of prison and things like that, find it very difficult to get banking services. There are kind of older and vulnerable people. I mean, I remember my my grandmother, who, I mean, my grandmother died over 20 years ago, 25 years ago, I think. But, I mean, she was very mistrustful. She would never use a credit card. She would only spend money that she actually had. My great aunt, who was 102 when she died, I mean, she was the same. Yeah, so they would never use. They were happy using cash. They stuck with what they knew. So I imagine there are plenty of people in the UK who are still like that. Cash is what they know. They understand it. They can hold it in their hands. You know, they may live from paycheck to paycheck. They don't want to spend more than they have, and good for them. But, you know, by not having access to banking services, they're really losing out.
Yeah.
So the problem is that banking services require a lot of infrastructure, as we've seen.
Yeah.
You can't just say, well, why not get these people a bank account? And this goes back to what you were saying, like, why are so many people in, say, Morocco or Egypt, say, why are so many people unbanked? Well, it can be a number of factors. In order to bring banking to people, especially in rural areas, you need to set up that infrastructure. You need to build bank branches. You need to staff them. You need to have ways of getting cash to these bank branches. These bank branches need to be, you know, I'd say today they need to be internet ready. You know, they need to be linked up to the internet. They need to be linked into the whole system, as it were. So if you're living in the middle of nowhere, if you're a cattle herder in Kenya, say, in the middle of the Serengeti, it's not easy to bring banking services to you. You've got a lot of the world's poorest countries have the highest levels of unbanked people. They often have large, often rural populations, remote areas. So banks either don't have the resources, or sometimes, let's face it, the banks just can't be bothered to spend the money to try and to bring banking services to these people, because poor people
don't have money.
Yeah.
And what's the point of giving them a service if they don't have any money to put in? I was just on my phone there because...
Because you were drifting off.
No. I wanted to find out what percentage of the world doesn't have access to the internet.
Okay.
And it's 60% of the world has access to the internet.
It's amazing, isn't it?
70% of the country doesn't have a bank.
Yeah.
Crazy.
It's a crazy thing. But it's interesting that you draw that comparison because, access to the internet is still... I mean, 60% of the world is great in a way, but it's still 40%.
Still 40%, yeah.
Yeah, still 40% who, again, don't have access to something that we utterly take for granted. I mean, yeah, we have... our central London office, our internet is very touch and go, and we completely lose our marbles over it all the time.
80% of the world has a smartphone.
Well, yeah, we're going to talk about this in just a moment because that is a very relevant statistic. But actually, the business of internet connectivity across the world, it's much, much easier to connect people to the internet than it is to build banking infrastructure.
Yeah.
And this is going to be crucial when we come to talk about cryptos. And this is one of the reasons, another reason why crypto is becoming so popular, because it's much, much easier to get someone online and again through their smartphone, which more and more people have.
80% of the world has a smartphone. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. So those payment rails, that infrastructure is advancing much quicker than perhaps regular banking infrastructure ever can. But yeah, as you say, poorer people, they have less money, so banks can't make such big profits off them.
There's no return on the investment of opening up a branch there.
Yeah.
What's the point?
Yeah, or you know, they might
shekels.
Yeah, they won't make much of a profit. And so the banks view as big bad capitalist entities is, if there's no profit, then why bother? I mean, you've got to see their side of it.
Yeah.
I mean, but it does, you know, it sucks for all these people. And let's touch on something again that we mentioned earlier. But this idea of remittances, because many of the unbanked around the world are at the same time those people who also rely on remittance payments. So obviously that they might have, we discussed it in detail a few minutes ago, but yeah, relatives working abroad, sending money home to their families. Now, according to the World Bank, and this is a direct quote here, officially recorded remittance flows to low and middle income countries reached $540 billion in 2020. Now, that was down slightly from 2019, but that was as a result of...
pandemic.
Of COVID, of people perhaps, you know, returning to their countries of origin, not working abroad so much. Yeah, that's a huge amount of money. Every single year, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars every single year are sent back to poorer and middle-income countries in the form of remittances. And for many of these countries, actually, remittance payments make up more of GDP, gross domestic product, than actual exports do. So they quite literally
survive off this.
Yeah, yeah. So again, and here's the World Bank again, another quote, globally sending remittances costs an average of 6.38% of the amount sent.
Jeez.
Yeah. Now, I got my calculator out here. I got my brain whirring away. And that is around
34.5 billion.
Yeah. That's impressive.
Yeah.
That's good. Tip of the cap to you, sir. Yeah, 34.5 billion every year going into the pockets of remittance providers. And again, that's your Western Unions, your MoneyGrams, etc., which could otherwise be going into the pockets of the world's poorest people. Both the unbanked and the remittance market, they are both set to be massively disrupted by crypto, as we'll see in later episodes. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Now, just before we wrap things up, I want to quickly take a look at an interesting kind of middle way solution to the problem of the unbanked. And for this, we're going back to Kenya, the Kenyans and their shillings. And this is something called M-Pesa. Have you heard of M-Pesa?
No.
Okay. So this was a scheme that was launched in Kenya in 2007 by Safaricom. Now, Safaricom is Kenya's biggest telecom company. And I think they've now been bought by Vodafone. I think they're a subsidiary of Vodafone now. The M is for mobile. And pesa is money in Swahili.
Okay.
Quite literally, mobile money. And it works like this. So M-Pesa customers, they open an account and they get an e-wallet on their phone.
Nice.
Now, we talked about how many people have access to phones. They then use cash. So they get this cash that they've maybe been stashing away or that they've earned working, however they come across it. They then buy credits from an M-Pesa agent. And these credits are then stored on their phone's wallet. So they hand over cash and their wallet balance on their phone gets updated as a result. And they can then send these credits
to
others. Yeah, kind of. Yeah, exactly. They can send these credits to others in order to transact. And all they do is they send it via their phones. And this makes use of Safaricom's existing infrastructure. So, the mobile network that Safaricom has built up across Kenya. And it also obviously had Safaricom agents working across the country. So yeah. These were all kind of co-opted for the M-Pesa network. And M-Pesa now has 50 million customers, mostly across Africa. They did trial it, I think, in India. But I gather it wasn't such a success there. But it has been. It's the trial that they did in Kenya was apparently enormously successful. And they did it, I think, for about 3 months. And way before the trial was due to expire, they had people coming back to them saying, "This is amazing. You've got to keep this going. I'm telling all my friends about it and all this sort of stuff." And it's made life a lot easier for a lot of people in Africa. But the problem is it still relies on people depositing cash with agents. And then imagine you're an agent in a very remote part of Kenya. Mm. Somewhere loads of people have been giving you cash maybe over the month or something like that in order to get their e-wallets topped up. You then have a pile of cash. If you're in the middle of nowhere, you've got to get that to a bank. Again, transporting large amounts of cash is going to make anyone nervous. Mm. And obviously, if you're a sole trader, if you're the only agent, you can't trade whilst you're hiking all that cash to the bank.
Yeah.
So M-Pesa, 50 million.
There's limitations on it. It's great.
Yeah.
But it's not perfect. It still has the same pitfalls that traditional banking does. It just it offloads them onto sole traders.
Exactly. So I think of it, 50 million customers is a lot, but actually in the grand scheme of things,
it's not 1.63 billion.
Yeah, it's certainly not. And even, the likes of PayPal and stuff, as we've seen, dwarf it. Yeah, 1.25 billion for WeChat Pay. So, the African market is huge. I think kind of 50 million, although it's on the face of it an impressive number, I think it shows that, there is kind of limited scope for it. So, but I like to see M-Pesa as a kind of halfway house between the traditional banking system and an entirely new way of doing things. Like, you know, it's made use of the fact that people are more mobile and, you know, they have smartphones and whatever. So, you know, that's great and they don't have to carry cash around. But still, it's still kind of having to interact with the regular banking system at some
point. I remember when there were crypto cash machines where you'd feed cash in.
Mm-hmm. There still are.
Yeah. Oh, they're still about.
Yeah, still Bitcoin ATMs.
Okay.
I think you can get, I mean, it's mostly Bitcoin ATMs, but you can also get, you can get some other cryptos.
Yeah.
Most of them, you, I think a lot of them you now have to hand over KYC. You actually have to put in identity details, which is not ideal. But yeah, the idea of exchanging.
What does KYC stand for?
Know your customer.
Okay.
Yeah. This is a big thing at the moment because crypto exchanges and banks and all this sort of stuff are you know, you're having to submit this information. It basically identify yourself and prove who you are, proof of address, you know, photographs of ID documents and all this sort of stuff. And it's all done in the name of anti-money laundering, you know, anti-crime. Which is fair enough, but you know, again, it comes back to this thing of privacy that we were talking about earlier, and yeah, there are tons of reasons why we might quite legitimately not want people to see what we're spending our money on, and I don't think you have to be a huge kind of privacy hawk to feel like that. I think everyone is should be guaranteed some degree of privacy. Everyone has a right. Privacy is a right and not a privilege, or at least it should be. I think that's a good point to kind of wrap things up a little bit.
Yeah.
So let's go through the points I think that we've talked about today. So a lot more happens than we think when we make a payment.
A lot of people involved.
Yeah, a lot of moving parts. Cash is useful in some circumstances, but it's becoming less and less a part of our lives, certainly in the developed world. I haven't used cash in weeks.
Not getting a bus.
Yeah, or buses. Banking requires significant infrastructure and oversight. Way more people are unbanked than you might think, and this locks them out of the world economy and it keeps them poor. So what this leads me to believe is if only there was a way of transferring money between ourselves that didn't involve banks, third parties, costs, extensive infrastructure, and that was available to more people across the world, not just the 69%. What could it be? Thanks for listening, everyone. I hope that was useful. I will put some materials in the show notes so you can see where I got a lot of this information from. And stay tuned for our next episode. It's been a pleasure. Mike, anything you'd like to say?
No, keep getting buses.
Keep getting buses. There's a mantra to live by. Goodbye, everyone.
Ta-ta.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. The Coin Bureau podcast is a production of iHeartRadio.
Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
So I know you've got a lot going on, but remember, I'm here for you. So bother me when no one's listening, because I will. Bother me when it feels like it won't get better, because it can. Bother me because you're never a bother. Whether it's a low point or a crisis, get help for yourself or a friend. Learn more at neverabother.org or call or text 988, available 24/7.